Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, your host for this hour of debate, dialogue, healthcare, science, discussions of all of the above, and also answers to your questions via email or phone. But before we go any further, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program are those of the speakers and not necessarily those of the station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It's not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. So let's start out with a very, very important and interesting story, hot off the presses, if you will. And this is regarding MRI contrast agents. Now, there's a compound called gadolinium, which is a rare earth metal that is the centerpiece of the contrast agent that's injected into your veins when you have an MRI. And there are different drug versions of this, and essentially these are protein carriers that hold that metal ion in their center. And the important thing about this is the widespread ubiquity of gadolinium. I've mentioned this before on the program because about 7 or 8 years ago, I started doing evoked heavy metal testing on patients, and I was looking for lead and mercury because I had learned a lot about how mercury affects the intestines and the brain and how in some people it leaches from their fillings. And so I was looking just to see what was out there, and in patients with neuropathy that I couldn't explain, I would investigate. Well, I'm not going to get into a discussion of heavy metals, but just to say that one of the things that I found was that I could tell whether a person had ever had an MRI by the fact that they would have a ton of gadolinium in their system. Now, none in their bloodstream, you understand. It goes into hiding. It goes into storage somewhere. And this evoked, what evoked means or provoked is that you give a chelating agent and then you'd collect urine. And in this situation, wherever there are heavy metals, the chelating agent goes and ferrets them out and carries them into the urine. Well, I wondered what the implications of that were, but I've been assured that the only known medical complication is in people with severe renal disease. They can get fibrosis in their kidneys from from gadolinium, and otherwise it's been presumed to be benign. And we're talking about 30 years of MRI scans. Researchers in France just published this. It came in Investigative Radiology, and I wanted to bring it to your attention because what the scientists did was they looked at the different types of gadolinium, and they gave over 5 weeks, one group of rats received 20 injections. And you know, that would be the equivalent of getting 20 MRIs in a short period of time. And they looked at the brains in these rats, and they saw a change. In other words, they could see that gadolinium was depositing in the brains, or they could see that something was depositing in the brains. And this being a rat study, at the end of the study, they actually killed the rats, opened up their brains, and tested. And indeed, they established that this heavy metal was depositing in the brains. Now, I want to emphasize there's no behavioral correlate here, but nevertheless, the concept that this can happen, and anytime anything's depositing in the brain, we want to be really kind of concerned about that, just on general principle, since Parkinson's and Alzheimer's are both conditions where stuff deposits in the brain. We don't think that's a good idea. Well, there are two types of contrast material that are used in MRI. And for the moment, I'm just putting out a precautionary principle here. The two types are called linear and macrocyclic. And the macrocyclic molecules are bigger and they look to be safer. So I have posted on the website a list of gadolinium contrast agents. And if you have to go for an MRI, I think you should, at this point, just to be on the safe side, let's request the macrocyclic type of contrast agent. And maybe we can keep ourselves safe. At least in this study, those did not deposit in the brain. Now, the people who funded the study are at least partially, this was funded by a pharmaceutical company. So maybe there's some conflict of interest there. This is a preliminary study. It has not been replicated in another lab. This is all very new and early. But I'll tell you, folks, if I had to have an MRI next week, I'd probably try to get it with a macrocyclic form of contrast agent. And I'll follow up on this story about availability in our local community. But if you are facing an MRI in the next few weeks, you might want to just check that list. It'll be posted in the resources page at AskDrDawn.com. Now, some good news. Good news for asthma sufferers. A new drug that's not a monoclonal with an infinite patent, something that already exists, and it is effectively a local anesthetic for asthma. In the lung, there are specialized sensory neurons called nociceptors. Nocio is, it's pain receptors, basically, inside the linings of your airway and your lungs. And these pain receptors become sensitized in conditions of inflammation, and they become part of a feedback loop. That's right. The inflammation triggers the nociceptors to release chemicals that cause in-migration of inflammatory cells. So you've got a positive feedback loop going. And if you can break a positive feedback loop, well, that's a good thing. All of our current treatments for asthma are essentially reversing inflammation, which is a very good thing to be doing, and I'm not putting it down, but it does involve the use of inhaled steroids. And while these are safe at small doses, the larger a dose you need to suppress inflammation, the more systemic absorption you can get. And it would be lovely if we only had to use small doses of anti-inflammatories periodically rather than high doses all the time. And in some individuals, that's the situation, high doses all the time. So there's a feedback loop we can now break on the nociceptive end. In other words, we have a second lever to pull to break this. It's a compound called QX314, and it's very similar to lidocaine, the local anesthetic that might be injected if you had to have stitches or a skin biopsy. But QX314 isn't normally able to get into nerve cells, except for these small fiber nociceptors in the lungs. So this can be delivered by inhalation, and it will only basically get into nociceptors which have been activated by inflammation. So it's a very specific and direct treatment. We've tried using lidocaine in the lungs, but the problem is that the lidocaine works on all the neurons. So the person has problems protecting their airway because you've numbed up their gag reflex. This is not a good idea. They can get aspiration pneumonia and asthmatic. That's terrible. So this is lovely new information, and I'm hoping to see a therapeutic product out there in the next few years, because as I said, this is already available, and we know about it, but we haven't had a use for it until now. So good news for asthma. Well, our first email, actually, I have two emails. One comes from Gabriel in Ireland, and the other comes from Matthew in Los Angeles, and they're both related to high doses of vitamin D. So let me read Gabriel's email first. You recently mentioned that bolus dose therapy of vitamin D can possibly be harmful. As I, on and off, supplement with 50 IU twice weekly for circa 6 weeks, could you please qualify your comment? And then Matthew writes, vitamin D2 dosage. My mom's doctor recently prescribed a dosage of 50,000 units of vitamin D2 once a week for vitamin D deficiency. My wife recently had a doctor prescribe the same dosage, only to have another doctor tell her that he thought that was way too much. What's your thought on this? Thank you, doctor. Love your show. Okay, guys. Well, first of all, let's talk a little bit about vitamin D2 versus vitamin D3. I suspect that given that Gabriel is in a country that has national health, he's probably being given D2. D2 is cheaper, and it is, in my opinion, inferior. It is not the natural vitamin D that your own body produces. It will act like it, but it may have other properties. Remember, vitamin D is a hormone, not a vitamin. And we all know that the devil's in the details with hormones, right? There's a difference between natural bioidentical estrogen and the horse estrogen Premarin, which is conjugated equine estrogens. We know that those are metabolized differently and are potentially at least more dangerous because they can form more of the type of estrogen breakdown product that attaches to DNA. So, hormones, very, very much you want the natural bioidentical variety. That's the D3. The other thing I don't like about the pulsed bolus dosing of vitamin D is that I know that with hormones, too much tends to turn off the effect that you're trying to get. Now, if I go out and spend the day in the sun, you know, and let's assume that I've done all my due precautions and I'm tolerating the sun, but basically a long day in the sun will get you about 10,000 units of vitamin D. So I look at what nature produces in the skin and I say, all right, that's about the most that I ever want to hit my body with at a given time. So I'm much more comfortable with people taking 5,000 to 10,000 daily than 50,000 once or twice a week, because I'm really worried about actually getting the opposite of the intended effect because of this characteristic that hormones have where too much of a hormone behaves just like not enough. And I don't know what that too much is. So precautionary principle here, folks, use, just like we were talking at the top of the show, precautionary principle here is use vitamin D3. Do not do bolus dosing. Use it, you know, every day, and you know, allow yourself to have 2 or 3 months to bring the vitamin D level up. That I think is the safest way to approach this. And I will say that there is literature showing that vitamin D has harmful effects, and all of that literature is the high dose pulsed dosing literature. Okay, that's what they're using. And then you get a headline, vitamin D causes osteoporosis. And then you go look at the methods section and they're giving pulse doses. And it's a small study and maybe it's coincidence, but you have to sort of read between the lines on these things. And in general, you want to mimic nature if you're going to try to work with nature. Our next email, the person did not fill in their name, but it's a very interesting question. The human biome. No surprise, you scooped him again on your June 13, 2015 opening segment on the microbiome, pre and probiotics, and gut health. Good complimentary piece. QED Forum had a great hour yesterday, 6:24, titled, Can Your Gut Bacteria Affect Your Mood? And the guests, I didn't hear this one, but I do plan to download it and listen to it. Continuing the email, not as detailed and specific as you got on the particular effects of certain gut critters, but very well laid out and understandable. They did have one call that took a bit of a swipe at functional medicine for promoting more is better on gut bacteria, although this can go overboard with, can't remember the symptom name, pushing bacteria from large intestine back into the small intestine. Well, anonymous contributor, that is called small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, and it's probably more common post-surgically of any kind, but we won't go there. One follow-up question. Both you and the KQED guests make many references to fiber. Could you do an on-air expansion on what exactly that means? From your use, it seems to mean complex carbohydrates that aren't necessarily broken down easily. In my mind, it's a picture of macroscopic stuff that you can't fully grind with your teeth, like the residue on the grater when you grate ginger. Maybe this is the same thing. It sounded like there are bacteria to process ferment some of these fibers. Are they like a smaller version of dust mites without whom we'd have piled up unbroken down skin residues covering the world? Well, actually, Anonymous, that's not a bad analogy. It's an ecosystem, and the bacteria that live in our intestines get two things from us primarily. They get protection from oxygen, which is toxic to the great majority of them, and they get a food supply. I'm sure you know about termites, and termites have a unique ability amongst I think carpenter ants is the other one, that have these special bacteria that can break down cellulose. Cellulose is a fiber. Fibers are carbohydrates. And if you think of a carbohydrate, think of it as a chain of sugars. And sugars, imagine a chain link but this time you've got a large ring and a small ring. And the large ring is the sugar. And between each large ring, there's a little tiny ring, and that is the chemical bond that holds the two sugars together. That gets digested by enzymes. And in your mouth, when you eat, say, a slice of bread, the sweet taste is the maltase in your mouth actually breaking down the carbohydrates and releasing sugars that can then stimulate the sweet taste buds. So we digest starch very quickly. It starts in the mouth, and by the time you get down to the stomach, it's hitting your bloodstream, you know, within literally seconds of ingesting it. Doesn't happen with fiber. Fiber essentially cannot be broken down in your intestine. You lack the enzymes. Not so for your gut bacteria. And the idea here is soil amendment. If you want to grow rhododendrons, I believe it's you have to acidify the soil. Please, gardeners, do not call in if I got that backwards and it's alkalizing the soil. It's just a metaphor. But you modify the soil to encourage the growth of certain plants. That's where these prebiotics come in. And what I learned at this last conference is that eating the right prebiotics allows you to have the right gut flora. And so that's where we stand at the moment in terms of keeping, well, stewardship of your inner garden. You want to eat a lot of fiber, and good sources of fiber I mentioned a couple of weeks ago, apples, also kiwis, jicama, Jerusalem artichoke, no one eats that. And there's a powder called inulin that's quite cheap that you can add to a beverage that is a good source of fiber for the types of bacteria you want to be growing in your gut. And I'm sorry, I may have gotten that right, that saliva had maltase in it. I think it actually is amylase. Thank you. Let's go to Anne in Santa Cruz. Hello, Anne. And
good morning.
Welcome.
Thank you. Kind of a funny little thing. I picked up on providing myself with good hygiene, mouth hygiene, about 6 months ago, and started brushing my tongue.
Uh-huh. And you changed your mouth flora.
Boy, did I, because now, and as soon as these symptoms started showing up, I quit the brushing. My tongue became very red and rough, and subsequently, the entire inside of my mouth has become extremely sensitive to acids and my toothpaste. This has been going on for about 3 months since I quit this tongue brushing regime. I could see that I was headed in the wrong direction. I took the problem to my dentist, and he was kind of nonchalant and had no ideas. Ran it by my nurse practitioner, and she suggested that I, suspend spicy foods, acid foods. But that doesn't seem to be making a lot of progress.
I'm wondering if you're zinc deficient. Yeah, what I would do is ask your nurse practitioner or to order a red blood cell zinc. And also, while you're at it, you might want to look at your B12 levels and your folic acid levels. And I prefer to look at homocysteine and methylmalonic acid because there's a lot of biological variability in people. But the B vitamins and zinc are really important for epithelialization, that is to say, skin healing. I would, and when you get glossitis, which is what you're describing with the red sore tongue, and one more deficiency, iron deficiency can also manifest as glossitis. So you've got zinc, iron, and the B vitamins to look for, and it may be that you were borderline deficient. And when you broke up, that you had some physical trauma when you broke up the biofilm. Also, when you broke up that biofilm, you might have been a little too enthusiastic about it and had more toxin released than your system could handle. And I'm not really quite sure how you triggered it. I also don't know what dentifrice you're using. Sometimes the you could be reacting to fluoride. That could cause this type of a reaction. So take the fluoride out of your toothpaste.
Yeah, it really burns too.
Yeah. I think you may have set yourself up for an allergy. You know, trauma and then inflamed it. There's multiple possibilities here that, you know, this is really interesting. I'm going to just talk to this. It's not on your topic exactly, but they don't teach doctors anything at all about the mouth. It's like this conspiracy. They don't even teach us the names of the teeth, you know, how they're numbered. They don't teach us about gum disease, which we know is fundamental for stroke risk and Alzheimer's. You know, if you've got bad dentition, your risk for those two things go way up, and we don't learn anything. And it's a conspiracy because, you know, the dentist staked out the mouth, and even though it's like part of the body, we don't get to learn anything about it. It drives me nuts sometimes because I don't like to be ignorant, and I'm working on my knowledge and understanding of this. I'm not sure I believe a lot of what I see in the dental textbooks because it seems to run contrary to common sense. Mm-hmm. You know, like, oh, we can put mercury in your mouth, but don't worry, you'll never absorb any of it. Or, oh, yeah, we can, you know, put this toxic compound that we would, you know, never dream of letting you ingest, but we're going to stuff it into the base of a tooth root that we've, you know, quote unquote, reamed out. Yeah. And I'm like, there's no way, using a little scraper, that you can get all the bacteria out of a tiny hole in bone. Mm-hmm. I mean, we know that medically. So like I said, I look at the dental literature and I go, huh? And then I think, well, I don't know anything about the mouth, and these people say they do. Anyway, I'm just left feeling like there's a lot of work to be done in this department. And I'd love to find, you know, stuff I could believe in, but I don't know if it's out there. If somebody has any suggestions for what I might read that isn't political, please. You know, there's so much opinion out there right now. Sorry, I had to go off on that one.
That's all right. It's all related. I am taking B12 daily. I'm just looking at my...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but you might not absorb it. There's two things that can happen that interfere with absorbing B12 orally. Right. And so if you had that sneak up on you, you wouldn't notice it, but it could be a factor here. Anyway, those are the things off the top of my head I would say check out.
Okay, thanks for your time.
You're welcome. Thanks for the call.
Uh-huh. Bye.
Not a topic we hear often, so definitely worth discussing. Let's go to Lynn in Santa Cruz. Hi, Lynn.
Hello.
Hello.
I recently had an MRI and was asked to sign a consent form for gadolinium.
Yes, you were.
But I wasn't able to get information that made me feel comfortable with it.
Mm-hmm.
The consent form was very brief, and it didn't describe how much more useful it would be to have gadolinium and so forth. So I did not sign it. And now that you've given information, I might, feel more comfortable if I know the type of gadolinium and sign in a future. But I'm just wondering, are they of benefit without the contrast dye, or is there a large difference?
There's a large difference, and it's analogous to the use of iodine in CT scans. What the gadolinium does is it allows us to see the different tissues, so we can see the difference between blood and nerve. You know, you think about the density of tissues, and if they've got roughly the same density, they'll absorb and emit this electron at the same level. So it's hard to separate them. It's like a low contrast photograph versus a high contrast photograph, right? You just get a lot more detail if you can see those lines between things.
Right.
Right. So, you know, imagine you play around on Photoshop with the contrast button. I'm sure you've seen how you can make an image pop. Well, that's effectively what gadolinium does. All right. So, this study that I talked about was multiple doses. It was a concept paper. So what it said was lots of MRIs with gadolinium, they could see it getting into and staying in the brains of these mice.
Right.
So one MRI, once the amounts are probably fairly low, and in terms of brain deposition. But what we saw was that the macrocyclic compounds, which exist And I'm looking, the nine most common agents used in the United States, three of them are macrocyclic.
Mm-hmm.
And the oldest one and the one with the largest market share is linear ionic. And that one's called MagnaVist, which just, you know, such a great trade name. You know, we're seeing magnetically, so MagnaVist, you know, it's good.
Oh, MagnaVist.
Good, good naming. But catchy, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But that would be the one to ask if that's what you had.
Oh, I didn't have any because I didn't sign the consent form.
All right, that's right. I'm sorry, you did say that.
But for the future, I would definitely ask that.
And what were they looking for with your MRI?
I had a gastrointestinal thrombal tumor, which was totally removed, but just to see if any cells migrated.
Okay, so that would be one of the circumstances where you might... you might need to do a contrast CT. I don't know if this tumor has any particular features that make it more visualizable by MRI, but a CT with ionic iodine contrast might be an alternative as far as turning up brain tumors. I do agree that finding brain tumors is probably important.
Well, it wasn't a brain. It was abdominal.
But okay, so they were looking in your abdomen for other versions of this.
That had been, that's the area where the tumor had been, yes.
I think what you should do is ask your doctor, how good was this study without the contrast?
Okay.
And would it be prudent for me to get another study with with one of these safer contrast agents? You know, this might be a path where you could feel comfortable using the contrast agent.
Yes, yes, I will. And on your website, you're going to have some...
we'll post the list and a link to the article. This is Ask Dr. Dawn, so www.AskDrDawn, DR or Doctor spelled out, they both work, .com. And then there'll be, and then you'll see my smiling face, and there'll be a resources tab. Click
on the
resources tab.
I just looked for the investigative radiology in France, and I wasn't able to find it. But I think on your website, once you've posted things, it'll be the information I need anyway.
Yes. Yeah, I won't trouble you with the actual article, but this link that I found with this list of contrast agents is excellent.
That'll be great.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Well, thank you for the call.
Sure thing.
Have a good day.
You too. Bye.
Bye. Let's see, we've got this email from, more on vitamin D. This is from Anna in Santa Cruz, and this was a controversy. One doctor ordered a 1,25-dihydroxy vitamin D test, and the other doctor ordered a 2,5-hydroxy vitamin D test. And each doctor is saying, no, my test is the right test. And Anna's confused. So, and the levels, by the way, were really different. So she's like, well, which is the right one and what should I do? So let's clarify this. The 2,5-hydroxy vitamin D is the one that is the storage form. And it reflects your body's supply. The 1,25-hydroxy vitamin D is the activated form. So that's the good stuff. That's the activated one. However, it varies according to external factors like inflammation. And so because it's a hormone, it responds to body signals. And therefore, it is a very poor measure of body sufficiency. So in other words, your supply is not reflected by the blood level of 1,25-hydroxy. So what question are you asking? And you're asking about, do I have enough vitamin D? You want the 2,5-hydroxy. Now, as you said, as Anna said, her 2,5-hydroxy was 23, and that is too low. So she does need work. She should probably get another one of these levels. Now, one last thing about this, because it is very, very new information for most doctors, and nobody has told them what to test, how to test, and what the implications are. So there's a lot of opinion out there that unfortunately is not well informed. And what we need to do is talk to each other and all get on the same page, because the data is out there that is very acceptable and very understandable. It's just a matter of presenting it to the right people. Let's go to Mary in Santa Cruz. Hello, Mary. All right. What can I do for you, love?
Okay. Yeah. I have my doctor tested my blood and for various things and noticed that I was a little under, I was borderline. My thyroid was not producing enough whatever it is. And then she did the other tests that I asked her for. And all of them, whatever they are, the thyroid, various ones. And I wanted to know, before I even contemplate adding artificial thyroid or thyroxine, whatever mm-hmm. it's called, I wanted to know the what I need to do in the natural department, you know, the instead of taking stuff.
Okay. So you said you had a borderline thyroid TSH.
What do they call it?
Well, there's thyroid stimulating hormone, which is generally referred to as TSH. It's a signal that comes from your pituitary gland, goes to your thyroid, and says, please make thyroid hormone. Just like the signal FSH goes from your pituitary to your ovary and says, please make estrogen. And so, of course, in a woman who's menstruating, she's got a high FSH level part of the month and a low FSH level the other part of the month, and that's how we regulate the menstrual cycle. In the case of the thyroid, there are certain physiological conditions where you might need more thyroid hormone, and so your TSH will send a loud signal to the thyroid, and if the thyroid's capable of responding, that loud signal drops back down again because the levels go up and everybody's happy. Now, that's step one, releasing the TSH, and the feedback loop from the pituitary depends on something called T4, which is the storage form of thyroid. So your thyroid gland, when it releases thyroid, releases about 90% T4 and 10% T3. And that circulates in your bloodstream, and the cells take it up, and then the T4 sits there until the cell decides it needs to make some T3. So you could think of it as like storage, and when the body converts it, it converts it in the periphery, that is to say, not in the gland so much as in the rest of you. And that conversion process can be impaired, and it's impaired when you're chronically ill. It's also impaired when you have a deficiency of iodine or selenium in your system. And so natural medicine uses iodine and selenium, and sometimes actually glandular extract, which is thyroid gland that has had the iodine, the hormone taken out of it, not the iodine, but the hormone removed. And those are standard natural treatments for the thyroid to try, and sometimes you'll even give tyrosine, which is the amino acid backbone of the hormone. And you're essentially trying to get the gland to be more efficient and make more hormone. And you're trying to get the body to convert that hormone into its active form. And that's the gist of what's going on. This is a nuanced discussion. We do not have the ability to look at your scores and tell you exactly what the implications are of those.
You said my T4 was in the normal range, or is in the typical range?
Yeah, well, the problem is those ranges are pretty broad. Huh? So what I do is, you know, for starters, if your T4 is, let's say, one quarter up from, if you take the range and you divided it into quartiles, that is to say, you know, divide it in half and then divide those in half and see where you fall in there. If your TSH is in a high quartile and your T4 is in a low quartile, that indicates that the gland is being pushed a little extra hard and is not performing efficiently. I also look at the T3. And by the way, you have to look at free T3 and free T4 to do this. And if the free T3 is in the, let's say, lower quartile, and the free T4 is in the upper quartile, then that means that the T4 is hanging around too much and you are not converting it or as well as you should be. And that's where I might use selenium and iodine, or even in some circumstances give people a tiny bit of T3. But you got to watch out with T3, because that's like amphetamine, and it'll if you overdose that, you'll get a rapid heartbeat. You'll give the person terrible side effects, a real overdose. And thyroid hormone overdose is nothing to mess with. It needs to be, so this needs to be very nuanced, and you need to watch it. Too much thyroid, among other things, may make you feel, it may actually make you feel energized and happy, but eventually you will get osteoporosis from too much thyroid. And so in women, that's particularly important. So I guess that's all I have to offer you right now.
I have started an iodine just myself.